And now, his weekly report, The Paranormal Moment with Joshua P. Warren. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. I like that, The Paranormal Moment with Joshua P. Warren, don't you?
Oh, yeah, I like it. And, you know, it's so perfect fitting for the idea that this is a moment in time when we stop and look at the past, the present, and the future, because, as you know, time is so integral to all these paranormal phenomena, George.
Absolutely. Have you had a chance to get up to our website to see the picture of what could be a dead creature alien? I think it looks like one of those hairless sloths. And these kids apparently in Panama stoned this poor thing.
Okay, I'm looking at it right now, and, you know, it is
weird.
It's strange. I mean, we don't have enough information yet to determine what this thing is, and goodness knows we are very familiar with hoaxes, so we reserve judgment. But, you know, you'd think that you would maybe try to take a better picture than that if you actually had a dead creature there. So it's kind of suspicious right off the bat. But, you know, that's the whole purpose of studying some of these hoaxes. And in fact, you know, as you mentioned, tonight's report is called Facing the Aliens. And what I mean by that is, what exactly is it like to come face to face with these beings? Because the idea of aliens visiting Earth is tossed around so often that sometimes we get numb to the reality of just how shocking it would be for one of your listeners to actually have a face-to-face experience. And in order to understand the magnitude of that, I'm going to try to paint this mental portrait tonight of exactly who some of these beings are, how they get here, what it's like to face them. But first, let's look at why it's so extraordinary when we have good footage, good pictures, because, as you know, last Saturday was the UFO contest, the Speaking of Strange UFO experience that I hold every year when we ask people to come from around the country and create fake UFOs.
Yep.
So we can look at them to determine what is real and what is not when we analyze UFO imagery. So we had a daytime competition this year.
That's unusual, because you always did these at night.
Yeah, you know, at night, it's really easy to hoax something, relatively speaking, because all you have to worry about is the illusion created by the illuminated portion. So, you know, you could hook some craft with blinking lights to a clump of balloons, and as long as the balloons are not illuminated, you never realize they're being suspended. Not so easy in the daytime, you would think. But I must say, it's a bit perturbing, because the winners of our daytime competition, Ron and Missy Hill, who are investigators here in Western North Carolina, where I live, they won the daytime competition by basically taking a product off the shelf that was more or less ready to go, and then knowing how to properly manipulate it in the sky. They got this sort of silver mylar shiny donut shaped object that was already full of helium, just modified it ever so slightly with some aluminum foil. Ron put this thing up in the sky, first on a tether so that he could kind of control it and whip it around from side to side, and it looked so impressive with that sunlight glinting off of it that when he cut the tether and this thing went soaring off over the mountains and beyond, there were people standing on their porches far in the distance who may not have known that we had this event going on. And you could hear them hooping and hollering, and dogs were barking. And so we may have, you know, accidentally been responsible for some sightings there. But, you know, this was still an example of something that was so compelling and yet so relatively easy to produce. In fact, at coasttocoastam.com, there is a link to my site, joshuapwarren.com, where your listeners can go and look at Ron and Missy's daytime UFO and ask yourself if you would have been fooled. Now, the winner of our nighttime competition was Jim Robison, who won the second year in a row using these multi-stage hot air balloons that he custom designs. And these balloons get up in the sky, and they go through various stages where they change color and they shoot different sparks out. And then when they reach a certain elevation, the whole thing just explodes into a ball of fire and vaporizes, and it's just spectacular. So looking at these for 5 years, and I mean, you know, this was our fifth year in a row.
And it's great work by these people, by the way.
It's so impressive because these are really creative folks. And the only rules are these things have to be able to fly on their own, and they have to be safe. And I have seen people use, of course, the helium, rotors, rockets, even just one guy threw his up in the air and didn't fly very far. When you see all of this, it makes you realize what the realistic boundaries are on what the average person with a few dollars, or in some cases a few hundred dollars, can put up in the sky. When I look at some of these videos that are coming out of Mexico right now, and just for comparison, also on my site there, I posted a video that we talked about a while back on this show, but it's worth repeating. This is a video from Mexico that shows some orange kind of amorphous object in the sky, and it shoots these jets out of either side, and those jets instantly congeal into spheres, which then sort of zip around each other. I can look at that, and I can tell you, in my opinion, unless this was something that was masterfully done in post-production, that this could not be done as a physically faked object in the sky. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that, you know, you can mimic that. Some of these flying serpents that we're getting are so strange that I am even more inspired when I see this stuff, because I know how difficult it is. I mean, most of the people who come to this competition, they can't even get their UFO off of the ground because they underestimate the amount of thrust and lift that their power supply has.
Joshua, several months ago, astronomers spotted an Earth-like planet. Today, they reveal that they are now convinced it's an Earth-like planet, except it's too close to its star, so it cooks like Hades. But I had Daniel Derda on today. He's a planetary scientist. He's convinced that almost every star now, he believes, must have planets around it. And as you know, there are countless number of stars. I mean, we can't count them. There are billions of billions. If that means that each star will have anywhere from 1 to 6 to 7 or 8 planets around them, they've got to harbor life, some of them.
Well, you know, that is a fantastic point, and it is really further enhanced when you start looking at the experiences themselves, because when you consider that for decades, people have been trying to solve this mystery, and I mean, look, Roswell now occurred over 60 years ago. It seems like a lot of these researchers who are looking at the nuts and bolts of how did they get from these stars light years away to here, they are sort of going in circles, and it's frustrating because it looks like we haven't made a lot of progress. And that's why what I'd like to do here is sort of present a fresh perspective on what is happening. And this is maybe a concise overview, we'll call it, upon interviewing many eyewitnesses, reading great resource materials. And the number one thing to think about is this interface by which we experience these visitors. And I tend to call them paratemporals because it's a more accurate term. I won't go deeply into that right now, but in my controversial new book, The Secret Wisdom of Kukulkan, I explain how the paratemporality and the paratemporal is relevant, which ties into what we were discussing with time. It's about our perception of how time and space are warped.
And Kukulkan being the serpent god of the Mayans, right?
Absolutely, yes. And you find all these examples of these serpent-type beings, reptilians, and all these ancient cultures. Let me present this for the listeners, because you hear this term interdimensional all the time, and it almost seems like a catch-all for anything you want to stuff into this bag of, you know, this blank unknown slate. Well, if you have a television And that television is turned on, and there are little people walking around on the screen. And you open the top on that television and show it to, you know, a caveman. We can presume the caveman would scratch his head because he looks into the box and he can't find where the little people are. Well, we know that the little people are actually bits of information, that these are representations of a person. When I watch TV and I see George Norrie pop up on the screen, I know that I'm looking at a representation of George Norrie, but George Norrie's not really there. What these beings have learned to do is take that little image of George Norrie on the screen and attach George Norrie's consciousness to it. And the TV is what we're walking around in every day, this thing we call reality. So we are coming into contact with these visual representations, which can transform, which can morph into different things depending upon the situation and the expectations of the observer, and also have intelligence because this intelligence is being, for lack of a better word, broadcast via that representation. And altogether, we can call this a holographic or a holosentient universe.
Well, as you so greatly quote Edgar Allan Poe, all that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream.
There you go. That says a lot, doesn't it?
Yep.
And how do we know the difference? You know, what is knowing? It's like asking the question, how do you know that George Washington lived? People say he lived. There are all kinds of documents, and there are different opinions about the fact that he was there. But how do you know that George Washington was there?
We weren't there.
That's right.
Like Jesus, we weren't there. Now, faith will tell you he existed, but how do you really know?
Yeah. And so, therefore, when it comes to understanding what it is like to encounter these beings, our minds must be very open to the fact that if a person experiences an encounter, then to some degree that encounter is real. And I'm not saying that we have no standard by which to judge this collective reality, but what I have done here is interviewed a lot of people who have had contact with these beings, and I've read great books, for example, there's one published by Tim Beckley, which is a fantastic resource called, he was on your show recently.
Yeah, good guy.
Underground Alien Biolab at Dulce, or some of, David Icke's stuff, Children of the Matrix. And, you know, you mentioned the reptilians, George, and if you look even from a biblical perspective, the Bible more or less kind of really kicks off when Eve encounters this reptilian being in the Garden of Eden. Or if you go to Central and South America, you have Kukulkan, the feathered serpent. Or if you go to Europe, you have the dragons. And so the types of beings that I believe we have the highest chances of coming into contact with face-to-face are of a reptilian sort. And of these reptilians, there are two basic divisions, the master reptilians and the slave reptilians. And let me give you some bits of information that most people may not really know about regarding encountering these face-to-face. Now, I've never had such an encounter, but this is from talking to a lot of people who have and reading these resources. Apparently, these master reptilians are about 6 to 7 feet tall, and they look like a big lizard standing upright. Some of them literally have a third eye in the middle of their forehead that is a vertical slit, and within that slit, you can see a blood ruby red eye.
Do they have tails or not?
Many of them do have tails, and they are so intimidating because they're about 10 to 12 times stronger than a human. And any time a person sees one of these things face-to-face, that person is overcome by a complete, gripping, utter fear and just a sense of being paralyzed with powerlessness. And if they say the best thing to do, if you meet one of these face-to-face, open up your hands and put them palm down at your sides, because that, in their mindset, means that you're not going to hurt them. Now, these aren't stupid creatures. Most of them speak English and a variety of other cosmic languages, so they say. Put your hands at your side, and if the thing hisses at you, then slowly back away, because apparently they cannot stand the smell of a human being. And if you slowly back away and you're so lucky, the reptilian will let you leave. Now, it's less known how their culture is set up than some of the information we have about the slave reptilians, which are essentially the gray types. And, you know, we all know that grays have big heads and big eyes and no hair. But from all the reports that I've gathered, they have sort of a totalitarian monarchical society. They're very pragmatic, cold, have no emotional sensitivity. And the leader usually wears a purple outfit, and the lower levels wear green, yellow, and white outfits. Now, here's a good tip that everybody should remember. There is an insignia, an emblem, that many of these grays, these lower-level aliens, apparently use. And if you ever see this insignia on any type of an operation, you might want to be wary, because there could be an involvement from these beings. Let me describe what it looks like. It is an X with a horizontal line across the bottom, a vertical line down the middle, and a dot on either side. And if you want to see what this looks like, I have this posted at joshuapwarren.com, as well as a sculpture of one of the reptilians that scientists believe could exist if dinosaurs had continued to evolve. Now, most of these creatures are actually naked, these little grays. They say they have no visible private parts. But when you see them and they appear gray, usually it's some type of a suit that's very strong. It would take an axe or something to break it open.
Right.
And you find inside that their skin is very thin and has a pale pinkish or yellowish or greenish color. Their body temperature is high, about 110 to 115 degrees Fahrenheit, and they feed on this disgusting, slushy protein shake of something like amniotic fluid, which they obtain from humans or animals. And if they go a few weeks without eating, they start to turn gray, and if they die, they are gray. They excrete their waste via osmosis, and these big black eyes are actually contacts or goggles because they're very light sensitive, and if you pull those away, you'll actually find these sort of vertical slit eyes that in some cases dart around like a gecko's. And they're also, of course, very telepathic, and all these creatures, it seems like, can sort of read the energy broadcasts that come from a human, especially fear. And when you start thinking about these beings from that point of view, you understand just how shocking it actually is for these people who come face to face with them. And if this is indeed what we're going to start seeing more of as 2012 and beyond rolls around, then we really have to start adjusting ourselves to something that is, well, creepy to say the least.
Joshua, they're out there. They're visiting, aren't they?
You know, there is this tendency to say, if I don't see it, I'm not going to believe it. But that's really a stupid way of looking at the world, because there are people out there who have experienced a lot of things that I never have. And I might never have that personal knowledge, but I have talked to enough people who have sincerity in their voices, who report the same kinds of experiences, even though they are spread all around in different locations, so that I tend to think, okay, there is a likelihood here that this is all true, and that likelihood is becoming more and more prominent because we have more people running around out there with cell phone cameras, and they're taking pictures of these things that we cannot explain.
We will be back in a moment to take your phone calls with Joshua Warren, The Paranormal Moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, a double guest series for you. Robert Zubrin joins us in the first couple hours as we talk about surviving and thriving on the red planet. And then we get to the red planet with George Haas and Bill Saunders as they talk about the Martian Codex, more reflections from Mars. Now, when we come right back, we'll take your phone calls with Joshua P. Warren on Coast to Coast AM. Joshua, I'm one of those who doesn't believe that government will disclose anything to do with UFOs. What do you think?
Yeah, unfortunately, I have to agree that the president is never going to stand up at a podium and announce that the visitors are here unless and until it is out of the control of the governments, because knowledge is power. And we see now, as much as ever, that governments actually operate by doing everything they can to keep information unless they have to reveal it. And it's understandable. I mean, in some ways, that does protect us. And we have to ask ourselves, would we reveal all of this information if we knew all the implications of it? But I, on the other hand, am not sure why that there is such a fascination with the fact that we need the governments to do this in order to advance. Because if you see a flying saucer or an alien, you know what's real. You know what your experience was. I'm not sure why we care collectively as a mainstream society about the fact that the governments have to acknowledge something, because knowing the way that our government representatives twist things around, even if they acknowledge something, then given their track record, I don't know that I would believe that anymore.
Let's go to the calls. First time caller, Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey, Scott, go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys? I listen all the time. It's great
Super.
To be on.
Thanks.
I just wanted to ask you, what are some of the circumstances that people might, you know, besides abductions, run into these visitors? I mean, has it been just chance encounters and it just scares the wits out of the people? Or, I mean, what happens?
Well, you know, Scott, that's an interesting question, because there are two ways of looking at that. On one hand, yes, indeed, you can kind of predict that if you go poking around a military base or an area where there are earth lights, like Brown Mountain, for example, and there is a lot of energy manifesting that might attract some visitor, that you might stumble into these things. On the other hand, there is a list of statistics which are very puzzling, and I don't know just how credible these are, but I've heard them over and over again. And if I'm remembering correctly, you have the highest chances of being abducted on a Wednesday night after 10 p.m. if you're driving in a car alone and you happen to be a school teacher and you are in either Nevada or Texas or Arizona.
Somewhat rural road, huh?
On a rural road, and your name is George. So how do you like that? You better watch out, George. So, you know, and if indeed these statistics are true, and these are just based upon gathering accounts from people who have come forth, we have to ask ourselves, are we seeing bits and pieces of some strange pattern that doesn't make sense to us, but makes perfect sense on a larger scale? And that also embodies, I believe, the challenge we have as these little creatures walking around on this little rock, trying to look up and understand the vastness of what is around us, what we are a part of. And we also fool ourselves, because nowadays the world, unfortunately, seems very small, because we have satellites that will take us from point to point in an instant, and we all know that the earth is round and these lights in the sky are other rocks, et cetera, et cetera. But in reality, still, we are just glimpsing little essences, little superficial parts of this huge picture around us. And I think the biggest problem that we have as humans is being so egocentric to think that we can comprehend these designs and plans that involve beings that have a timeline that might last thousands of years, when our timeline is, you know, 70, 80 years.
Next up, we go to Tempe, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Brian, good morning to you.
Hi. Hey, Josh. How you doing?
Hi there.
Yeah, I just had a quick comment and then a couple questions. I feel like I'm one of those people that you're talking about would be a good candidate for some of your experiments, and I was wondering how I might go about being one of your guinea pigs.
That's a very dangerous question, Brian.
Yes, it is. Oh, yeah.
So, okay, now what kinds of experiments do you have in mind?
Well, I think there's something very peculiar about my electromagnetic field. I seem to attract all kinds of high strangeness, and I even attract lightning quite frequently. I've had some pretty close encounters, and just through my own personal research, I feel it might be something to do with my own electromagnetic field being extremely strong. I'm also quite sensitive. I feel like I might have some mediumistic powers or something that I haven't tapped into yet. And I attract all the big three. I'm Bigfoot, ghosts, UFOs. I've had major confrontations with all three of them.
You know, and when it comes to your type of person, you fascinate me because I can relate to you in the sense that there are some people out there who seem to be on a life path in which they never experience anything paranormal. You can bring them with you to a haunted house, and you can almost guarantee you're not going to see a ghost. You take them to Brown Mountain, you can almost guarantee the Brown Mountain lights are not going to appear. And then you have people like yourself who are the exact opposite. And I really do feel like the moment that we enter this earth, the moment we're born into this realm, that we become part of a pattern that represents some system in place at that time. And this, you know, borders on astrology. And some people also tend to have this electromagnetic flow, this charisma, this ability to affect things around them, to make electronics mess up, to cause street lights to blink out when they're around. And I do want to test those kinds of people because you can take a little device called the Trifield Natural EM Meter, and you can go to a kindergarten class and find a child who has an energy field extending from his or her body 10 or 15 feet. And then you take a big 6-foot-tall fat guy and you put him right next to that kid, and his field is only 2 or 3 feet. And it's very difficult to explain that once you've ruled out conventional aspects of electrical insulation and so on. So for people who want to test themselves, and in fact, also on my website, I've mentioned before, I have this video clip of me moving a wheel, using some type of, you know, bioenergy influence, apparently, and you'll see what I mean. It's under a glass case and everything. There are lots of things I plan to do that I'm going to bring back on this show, talking about different types of people and how their bodies seem to produce various fields. And so just go there and email me at joshuapwarren.com, and maybe we'll hook you up to some electrodes, or maybe even give you a lobotomy.
Good for you. Let's go to Granbury, Texas, east of the Rockies. Vincent, you're on with Joshua Warren.
Hello, Joshua.
Hi there.
I'm going to take a left turn here. I know you're talking about Martians tonight, but I know you do some ghost hunting, too. I was wondering, what is your take on the Amityville horror case?
You know, I wrote an article a few years back about the Amityville horror case, and it really is a great example of how you can have a location where something truly horrific takes place, because we all know there was a mass murder there, and DeFeo, who committed these crimes, said that there was some demonic influence, as he described it. And there's no doubt about the fact that simply walking into that kind of a location, especially armed with that knowledge, it makes you uneasy. And so I have no doubt that the people who lived in that house...
The Lutz family, right?
Yes, the Lutzes. They encountered paranormal activity. But when they hired Jay Anson, the writer, to produce the embellished novelization of the story, things became really fuzzy at that point, as they always are.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing about ghostly encounters is usually when someone sees a ghost, the ghost appears and it scares the bejesus out of them, and then it disappears, and that's that. And stories, however, are based upon, you know, this ancient formula. You have to have, you know, 3 or 4 parts, and you have to have your peaks and valleys of drama. And somewhere in the midst of the real experience and how it is presented for a commercial product, a lot of the scientific value is lost. So I don't think that we are ever going to really know exactly what happened in that house unless maybe someday we are able to go in and do a formal investigation, which at this point I don't think is possible because the current owners don't want to really be associated with that. But the fact that people live there today shows you that the activity the Lutzes were experiencing either was temporary or it was not as extreme as you would think, because there are still people who these years later don't seem to have a problem with it. And that's a great sort of embodiment of what you find again and again and again when you've worked with as many TV shows and published as many books and so on as I have. There's always some editor or some producer saying, ooh, let's juice this up a little bit.
You know, it's interesting. Kathy Lutz, she died of emphysema in 2004. George Lutz died of heart disease in 2006. Ed Warren, of course, one of the investigators, he's passed on. It just seems like everybody associated with this thing may have died, or they're ready to. There was another guy named Kaplan. He died of a heart attack. I mean, he was the vampire expert and ghost hunter. Stay out of those places, Josh.
I think that there is such a thing as a curse. And a curse is a thought form that is so condensed that it takes on an independent external existence. I mean, recently I was reading about the curse of the Hope Diamond and how that there are people who believe that, you know, the Hope Diamond actually cursed the American people when it was donated to the Smithsonian. And you can go back and look at these stories regarding the Hope Diamond hundreds of years ago and say, this may or may not have been true. Some flashy salesman might have been trying to create an air of mystique around his product. But the fact of the matter is, when the Hope Diamond was delivered to the Smithsonian by, a U.S. Postal Service man, I think within a year after that man delivered it, he was in a car accident that pretty much crushed his legs and crippled him. And then he was in another accident in which his whole family died. And then his dog died, and then his house burned down.
Jeez.
And
lucky guy, right?
Yeah. And yet he was still saying, oh, I don't believe in curses. Well, you know, whether or not you believe these things, when you see a pattern of this kind of very defined negative phenomena occurring again and again, there is something there that we don't have to understand, but it must be respected. And if you believe that a thought is a thing that has physical implication, which clearly it does, because otherwise how am I, you know, moving my arm right now by simply thinking about it, then you also can take just a few steps to imagine that a thought can go beyond the body and travel in ways that impact the world around you for better or for worse.
And, you know, almost everybody associated with this diamond had some problems, even back to Louis the 14th.
Yeah, that is one of the stories that, he and Marie Antoinette had this in their possession, when the revolution occurred and they went to the guillotine. So, whether or not that is true, when you see that there are people who we can look at and document, like this delivery man, it just goes to show that whether or not the story was true, that there was something that's always been there, or whether we created this curse because we believed it, the end result is the same.
James Todd was the postman.
James Todd, there you go. Mm-hmm.
Hit by that truck.
Yeah.
Survived, then his life collapsed.
Yeah, and you see this all the time with cursed objects, and there are things that I would not get around. I have spent many years looking at objects that are haunted or cursed, and you can measure energy fields around them that are not supposed to be there.
We've got to get you to investigate Robert the Talking Doll.
The devil doll down here in Florida, I think Key West.
He's still in there. He's in a glass little enclosure now.
Yeah, you know, I have not seen him personally. I have good friends who have been down there, and they say that he is the sort of little doll that just makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. And they try to take pictures of this doll, but the pictures often are just white. They are just absolutely overexposed by some type of unknown energy. And dolls are especially significant, even if you look at the tradition of the voodoo doll. I mean, somebody takes a little doll and imagines that this doll is another person, and if they stick hair or fingernails on it, that just reinforces this. And all that it does, magically speaking, is help them to concentrate their thoughts, either positive or usually negative, on what they want to happen to that person. And it happens. We can't explain it, but it happens.
It does. Let's go to Texas City, Texas. Holly, let's squeeze in your question. Go ahead.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
Fascinating program, as usual. I had a question. You have some birth defects where children are born with partial tails.
Yes, yes.
Would it be out of the realm of possibility that we ultimately perhaps could be the missing link, so to speak, that those grays or the hairless beings are perhaps the donors.
All right, what do you think, Joshua? Because we've only got a minute to go, and she is correct. There are some children born with this tail-like appendage. It's a rare mal disease.
Yeah. Well, you know, I feel like that the great thing about science is that science is not a belief system. It is a way of approaching evidence, and science does change and evolve. And right now, you have, you know, genealogists and geneticists who might say, oh, there's no real evidence for the fact that we are anything other than the direct ancestor of an ape. But you know, it seems counterintuitive when you look around at how far we have advanced. We do things that no other creature does on this planet. We are like aliens here, and therefore it would not be surprising if we had a little help from some visitors from beyond.
Joshua, until next week, my friend.
Excellent. I look forward to it, George. Thank you.
Joshua P. Warren, his paranormal moment. Well, that wraps up tonight for Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.